Well, I certainly enjoyed the book.
And, oh, thank you.
As I started reading it, I thought I was reading a psychological novel, and a rather ambitious psychological novel. But I was pleasantly surprised
good.
to find
I was
out
worried.
That it became an old-fashioned thriller.
Yes, that's
with the chase and this sort of thing. So I was delighted. It's not that I dislike psychological novels, but psychological thrillers are even better. And so it really got gripping, especially about two-thirds in, when Wing, I think that's his name, right?
Yes.
Wing.
Yes.
Began to try to track down the girl that he had been calling on the sex line. Tell me a little bit about. Well, first, so I put this in perspective. I wasn't quite sure where the book was set. Where was it set?
The book was set in Maryland, and it could have been set anywhere, actually. This phenomenon of live telephone sex is really all across the country. For instance, in one issue of a men's magazine, I saw 72 ads of these services that operate around the clock. Now, altogether, I've counted about 150 different numbers. Now, of course, certainly many of them are owned by the same company, but it's widespread. But I would say the centers are of the operations are California and New York, but they are all over. And I deliberately made it Maryland because it shows that this is all over. I didn't want to just isolate it here.
Did you state it was Maryland? I don't recall.
I just state it's a fictional town near Baltimore.
I couldn't place it. Yes, I think it could be just about any place. Yeah. Well, I know that a lot of these outfits are based in California because I have a 17-year-old now, but at the time he was 15, I noticed a lot of strange calls going out to Hollywood, California, and expensive calls, too, and it didn't take me long to realize what he was calling.
Well, this is a different operation. You know, this is not the recorded sex. The recorded sex services have gotten a great deal of publicity, but there is almost no publicity about the live sex operations. And these, as you, from the book and from the ads, if you've seen any of them, are operate on the basis of credit cards for the most part. Although in my research, I did not use credit cards. I paid them in advance. But they try to be child-proof because they've got too good a thing going for them.
Well, obviously you saw the ads, and this sparked your interest in doing a story like this.
I would see the ads Voices Wanted, and of course, as you might gather, that's where the title came from.
Mm-hmm. So you called a few of these?
Oh, I've called. I spoke to at least 13 women, and I met two of them during the writing of the book, and I met a third who called me saying she had heard that I had written a book, and she herself, didn't identify herself as a in the sex business, sex telephone business, but when we got to talking, she said, "I am in the business." And it was uncanny, Don, how her story was like this story. She lives in an apartment with her teenage son, in my case it's a daughter, and one of her fears is that someone is going to trace her number.
Mm, that's exactly what happens
yes.
in Voices, of course. One thing that surprised me was that the atmosphere in which Dawn, whose real name is Lynn in the book, finds herself when she is employed by this outfit. It's actually very homey. The people are very nice. The people she works for are nice. It's just like she would report to work in a normal place.
That's exactly right. See, these operations, many of them work out of setups like that. It may be an apartment house where a number of the women work. But for the most part, most of these operations operate where the callers call a central operator, the men give their names and credit cards, and then the call goes out to what I call cottage workers, the women who work out of their apartments and homes. And they could make $200-$300 while their children are off at school.
What sort of women are these who work in places like this?
Well, the ones I've met and what I've heard about, they are housewives. They are college students. A good number, especially in Hollywood and California, rather, and in New York, are actresses between jobs or would-be actresses. This is incidentally, I've looked into this sex telephone business in a number of European countries. The only other country that I know that it exists in is France. And so it's not really an American phenomenon, but it's almost. And when I have told women, friends of mine, they say, "What's your book about?" And I have told them, unfailingly, if there are more than one woman there, they will turn to each other and say, "Hey, that's what we ought to do." Not that they would, but it sort of strikes something. And I find that very fascinating.
And these women will pattern their conversations to what the caller wants. Is
well,
that correct?
They will do whatever it's necessary. And many of them, and I played this role, where I pretended to be a very nervous caller, and in the beginning I indeed was. And, what are you interested in? What would you like me to do to you? That would be the one of the leading questions. And when I was acted very nervous, I deliberately wanted to see where they would lead me, and they led me plenty of interesting places. Now, these women are trained, and since there are different services, the training can consist of listening to several of the calls. To one woman whom I met had 4 weeks of training. And the training consists of desensitizing them to the use of these words and situations, also preparing them, building up their sense of fantasy, putting them in, acting out various situations on beaches and beds and airplanes, whatever needs be, and also how to deal with the various fetishes and perversions. And it's funny how one woman, when I said about use the word perversions, her training really was such, she said, "There is no such thing as a perversion. These are aberrations," which I thought was rather humorous.
Well, the villain in Voices, of course, is a psychopath. And this leads me to question about the mental stability of the people. Presumably they're mostly male or all male who call these numbers. They just can't be completely right to have to apparently find some sort of sexual gratification by making a telephone call like that.
Well, first of all, women do use the services, although far from the number of men that use it. But it's primarily the customer, when you speak of the customer, it's a male, primarily. And the types of customers who call range from the curiosity seekers who call just once to those who seem to be, or certainly are, maybe cottage fetishists, or have these, maybe their wives don't even know that they really want to cross-dress or any of the other perversions. But most of them are men who want words, positions, and what have you that they may not get elsewhere. Some are clergymen. Many are clergymen, from what the women told me. They are very proud of the fact that psychiatrists call them. And I said, "Well, why would a psychiatrist? What would he get out of you?" Just one woman in particular said, "Well, this particular psychiatrist said I am more knowledgeable practically about sex than he is, and he learns from me." Now, many of them rationalize their work in terms that they are therapists, in a sense. In fact, one woman in particular, they can so draw you into it that I was a case-hardened caller, calling from my home. My wife knew what I was doing, of course. My children knew what I was doing.
Hope she wasn't eavesdropping.
Yes. And I would send my pay in advance, and when I called this woman and said, "This is Joe," I didn't use my name, she said, "Well, you're lying to me. You didn't send any money. I would have gotten it. You only want a free call." She was very angry. About a week later, I called again. She said, "Joe, I am so sorry. I got your money. You must think I was going to advertise for you. I was going to advertise in the Boston, whatever." And she sounded so convincing. She had me believe that there was something about you I really liked. She drew me in, and I found myself thinking. And then when she went into the therapy that she performs in terms of people with sexual problems, I found myself almost embarrassed to say, "Well, how about fantasies?" But when I started, her voice changed, and she led me into quite a fantasy.
Well, I know that the women who are supplying the services are indeed supplying the service, but still have to believe that the men who call them have to be sick. They just have to be sick.
Well, they have this need, which they're. It seemed. I spoke to psychiatrists about this, and it's surprising how many of them didn't even know it's going on. It's surprising how many people do not know what's going on. They know about the recorded sex. The psychiatrists whom I spoke to seem to look on it as a problem when these men become a need to call more than once or twice, and when it becomes more than, hey, a curiosity thing, and when it replaces reality. And that is what in Voices it did. In fact, the voice he heard on the phone, Dawn's voice, became his reality. He was sexually crippled, and here was his salvation, if he could just meet this woman. And I could see this happening, and in that sense, yes, they're sick.
Where do you live?
I live in right outside Philadelphia suburb. It's called Overbrook Hills, and it's right outside Philadelphia.
Is writing a full-time occupation with
Yes,
you?
I've been writing forever. It is a full-time operation. This is my sixth novel. The last novel, The Captain, won a special Edgar Award. And this novel is a... the novel is published by Stein and Day, but it has been a Doubleday Book Club selection. So I'm absolutely delighted. My fear was that because of the subject, it would be automatically prejudged as sleaze. And... it worried me very much because that's not the kind of writing I do. I'm interested in writing on, not that I set out to do this, but it just seems to happen on some sociological subject or something that exists. My first book, which made the New York Times list, was called Anyone's My Name and dealt with capital punishment, basically.
Well, there's no question that the writing is skillfully done and on a high level. The topic at first may seem like, as you, I think you used the term sleaze, but it's certainly not that at all. And it takes a certain degree of concentration. It's not, you don't tell everything. You make the reader work, which indeed the reader should, as he should with any kind of literature. So it was extremely well done. How did you get into writing? This is your sixth book, you say?
Yes.
Yeah. When was your first one published?
1953. It goes way back. Mm-hmm. I published, and that was the one that was on the New York Times list, and really did very well. Then I didn't want to repeat myself. That was a what you might call, for lack of another term, I can't think of it, a psychological suspense, although I really hate to categorize it that way.
But you do focus primarily on mysteries.
I've never done a whodunit. Mm-hmm. The mystery, if there is a mystery, it is not a mystery in those sense. It would, if there are killers in it, everyone at some point you know who the killer is. It becomes more of will he do it, when will he do it, why will he do it, rather than whodunit. I am not a whodunit writer. So although it did win this special Edgar, it was not on the basis of being a mystery. In fact, I was a little concerned that it won this. I was very, very flattered, but I really hated it to be categorized as a mystery. This is a book we're talking about. It's called The Captain, which dealt with a police officer who was remanded to a nursing home, and he was a one-man. He still remained a policeman in the nursing home, meting out what he looked on as justice to those people who injured psychologically or in any other way the elderly. So it wasn't really a mystery.
Are you a Pennsylvanian? You live there now.
Yes, I've always been a Pennsylvania. Went to school in Pennsylvania.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Temple University, where I majored in journalism. And my first job, editorial job, was I was managing editor of a magazine called Official Detective Stories magazine. And I firmly believe that wherever you land originally is where, you know, you sort of... That's the direction which you go. Because I worked for a True Detective Story magazine, I started to write True Detective Stories. But I started also writing articles for Saturday Evening Post and Reader's Digest and most of the major magazines. I also wrote short stories for magazines, the literary type magazines. And then I think the second book I got married. I had first child. I have two children, and I turned more to articles. I've raised a family. I live in a suburbia. I supported my family on my writing, Then the time came, I felt, when it's time to go back to novels, which had always bothered me. And in 1982, although I published this, The Captain, 1983 I published a paperback original called Holy Secrets, which dealt with the potential abuse of psychiatry. In 85, Voices. So I'm making up for lost time, and I'm busily plotting out another one.
I certainly enjoyed reading Voices, Seymour Shubin, and it does shed some light, presumably accurately, on the way that the sex telephone business works, and it was certainly well done, and I'm also delighted that it was Stein and Day. I wanted to do another Saul Stein author for a while, and this was a perfect opportunity.
Ah, wonderful.
So I appreciate your coming in to fill me in on what you've been doing and to tell me about Voices, and I hope that we'll have a chance to get together again and talk some more.
I hope so, and thank you so much for inviting me. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you.